Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 67, recorded August 29th, 2012. Trust me, I'm lying. Triangulation is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, visit Stamps.com now, click the radio microphone, and enter Triangulation. And by Ford. Ford invites us tech geeks to join the conversation, submit ideas, and grab your tech geek badge at social.ford.com. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we sit down with interesting, smart people to talk about their ideas. It's kind of my favorite time of the week to take an hour and really dig deep on a subject. And boy, we've got an interesting, I think, fasten your seatbelts interview this week. Our guest is a director of marketing at American Apparel, but you probably know him for things he's done more in secret. Reminds me a little bit of the tricksters like Dick Tuck in the Nixonian era. His name is Ryan Holiday. Remember that name. His book, which crossed my desk about a month ago, and I said, what? And then I read it, and I said, what? Is Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator. Ryan's joining us from a secret location in Houston. Hi, Ryan.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. You write for or work for American Apparel still.
Yes.
But this book really talks about kind of guerrilla marketing you did for lots of people, including Dove Charney of American Apparel and Tucker Max and others, and how you used particularly blogs to completely control the story.
Yeah, what I wanted to do with the book was sort of rip back the curtain on how the media really works, because I don't think people understand how much the online news cycle really drives what you read in newspapers, what you hear on the radio, what you see on TV. And that's what I do for clients. I control that online news cycle, or I try to control it to influence what you see in a variety of other mediums. And I didn't feel like anyone had ever really exposed it, even though I think behind closed doors, a lot of people in the media all admit this stuff privately.
Right.
And I wanted to really give people a glimpse into that secret world.
You are being played, basically, is the message of the book. You are audience.
Yeah. Right, and they certainly are. I mean, websites look at you as clicks and views. They don't view you as readers who they want to serve with quality products necessarily, and so you are being used.
Is it blogs' fault? I mean, it didn't start with blogging. In fact,
you have a great
illustration in this book from the era of yellow journalism, Feeding the Monster.
Yeah, look, media manipulation has always existed, and I draw some distinct parallels to yellow journalism of old, but I think what we have now is so much faster, so much more interdependent, and so much more corrupt and in some ways evil than we've ever had before. So I wanted to basically show, like, look, all the old media criticism that you've heard, that's still right on point, and now it's worse than even they could have imagined.
Have you retired?
I wouldn't say that I gave up the game, but I wrote this book to fundamentally change the game, because it just eats at your soul to know that what you're doing is stirring up false controversy or generating false news or manufacturing what people read, because that's the only way to get attention online.
And when you say manufacturing, you really mean manufacturing. It's not merely spin. We're not talking spin here.
Right. We're talking about fake news becoming real news and generating real action.
Because you can get, and we've seen it happen with rumors. Apple rumors is an example. Everybody in this audience has seen that happen. In fact, it just happened recently with a Swedish blog that invented a picture of a fake screw and said Apple was screwing us by changing the screws. They put it on Reddit, and every single blog picked it up.
Yeah, and all these sites are trying to do is get to the story first. They're not trying to get to the story right. So no one has the time or even the financial motivation to stop and ask, is this real? Why is this news breaking? What does it mean? Is it important? And instead, they just rush to print. And I think they excuse a lot of those mistakes by saying, hey, we can always correct it. It's on the internet. But the reality is, you know, those things affect stock prices. They affect people's opinions. And it wastes a lot of time reading fake, bogus news.
Yeah. You particularly single out Mike Arrington and TechCrunch, Gawker, of course, and Nick Denton, The Huffington Post, sites like that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because those are three totally different verticals. You have tech, you have sort of Hollywood and Washington gossip, and then you have politics. And at the end of the day, they all publish basically the same stories in the same way, and that's short, gossipy, often unfact-checked pieces that generate a ton of traffic and attention and ripple through the rest of the media system. But since they all operate on the same business model, which is publish a lot of news, churn and burn with your writers, they see the world in the same way, and I think they distort the news fundamentally in the same way. I quote that. There's the famous Michael Arrington quote about, you know, getting it first is cheaper than getting it right, and I think that motto is at the root of Gawker and Huffington Post just as much as it is at the root of TechCrunch.
And Arrington always said, well, we're moving towards the truth. We'll update it, we'll correct it, we'll fix it.
Yeah, and my answer to that is... if you're not publishing the truth, what are you publishing, right? What do we pay? You're the journalist. Your job is to know what you're talking about. If you're just another guy throwing up rumors, I can just do that myself.
Right. So I have one more question. Then I want to get specific because I want to hear some stories because the book is full of some really kind of amazing stories that will underscore this. Are you blaming new media? Obviously, this has gone on for a long time, but is new media the culprit today?
I'll put it this way. There's more than enough blame to go around. It's not just blogs. It's not just social media. It's not just Twitter. It's the readers, too. But I would say that the fundamentally the business model of blogging, which is get a lot of traffic, sell it to advertisers, and then sell the whole thing to an old media company, is inherently problematic. And it sort of it turns everything they do into a conflict of interest because they're not looking to serve readers, they're looking to serve themselves and grow the business.
And what about the old media? Are they sucked into this, or are they participants?
Oh, totally. I mean, look, at the end of the day, the New York Times is competing with TechCrunch for the same finite amount of attention. And the two of them are all both competing against, you know, pornography and Facebook for everyone's attention. So we're all sort of caught up in this race to the bottom of competing for more and more people are competing for attention spans that aren't getting any larger.
And you were, as you admit, a master manipulator. You were really good at this. Tell me how you did it. Give me an example of how you would do this.
Yeah, so I mean, my job is to get attention for my clients at essentially any cost, particularly because I represent, you know, controversial clients who are kind of shut out from the rest of the media. Like Tucker Max's books don't get reviewed by the New York Times. So if he wants to get covered in the New York Times, he's got to do something pretty crazy. So I've done a variety of stunts. For his movie, we orchestrated a nationwide boycott and backlash against the movie, knowing that young men go and see or read books that people tell them specifically not to read. So we started
his movie, I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell.
Yes.
Before it came out, you organized protests against it.
Yeah, and what we actually did was we designed an advertising campaign that was deliberately offensive, and then I went out and I vandalized the billboards that we bought for the movie, which I took pictures of with my cell phone and leaked to two big blogs in Los Angeles, which, you know, of course, blew up on the internet, and then real people started vandalizing the billboards in other cities. And it became this whole movement that got tons of press coverage, way more than we ever could have afforded. It reached more people than we could have afforded to reach through traditional advertising.
You said
in a more authentic way.
You said in under 2 weeks and with no budget, thousands of college students protested the movie nationwide. Angry citizens vandalized our billboards in multiple neighborhoods. FoxNews.com ran a front page story about the backlash. Page 6 of the New York Post mentioned Tucker. The Chicago Transit Authority banned the ads from the buses and stripped them off the buses. And then you had two different editorials in the Washington Post and the Chicago Tribune against the film. None of that attention would have occurred had you not started the ball rolling intentionally.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very surreal moment to be on the phone pretending to be someone else complaining about ads that I designed and thought were kind of funny.
And then you put out a press release. Tucker Max responds to the Chicago Transit Authority, blow me.
And
it's almost too easy, isn't it, Ryan?
And it's crazy, and that, you know, that's very fun to do it, and I get excited about it. And so there, for a long time, there's sort of two parts of me. There's the part that can get really excited and spot these opportunities, and then the other nagging part of me that's saying, man, this is kind of scary. This started from, you know, an hour's work at 2 a.m. in Los Angeles, and here we have the biggest newspapers in the country talking about it. What could someone a little bit more evil than me do with these tactics? And that's kind of... honestly, that's the real reason that I expose them in the book. And, you know, people can question my motives, whatever. But the real reason I'm exposing them is I want people to know how easy it is, so maybe we can do something about it.
Have you ever heard of a guy named Dick Tuck?
No, I haven't.
You got to look, because he started this, and he was a Democratic operative who he's the guy who got a bunch of pregnant – remember Richard Nixon, when he was running for president, his slogan was Nixon's the one. He got a bunch of pregnant women to hold up the sign Nixon's the one at a Nixon rally.
Oh, that's amazing.
He's very famous for what was called the Chinatown caper. Nixon, when he was campaigning for governor in 62 in California, visited Chinatown in Los Angeles. There were children holding up signs in Chinese saying welcome. But he had somebody tell him it was asking him about something controversial that had happened before. And he took the sign on camera, took the sign and ripped it up, causing a huge scandal.
I think there's a great precedent.
There's a long
there's always
history.
Been guys like this. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a long history of that.
Keep going. Yeah. And so I kind of base the book on two of my favorite novels are The Harder They Fall by Bud Schulberg, and, right. and the other is All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren. And those are about media manipulators, you know, 100 years ago.
Yep.
And what I think is interesting is those books were very critical of those people, and the media sort of know that those guys were existing, and they tried to guard themselves against them, at least as much as they conceivably could. But today, the interests of bloggers and the interests of me and my clients are very much aligned in a kind of alarming way, where we're both trying to get as much attention as possible. The reason that blogs ran those fake leaked pictures that I took of the ads and didn't stop and try to verify who I was and make sure that they were real is they knew that doing the post would get a lot of attention and get a lot of traffic, which would pay them. So they're motivated to suspend disbelief,
right.
and sort of co-conspire with me on some of these activities.
Are there other people like you doing this?
I think so. I mean, look, I think Andrew Breitbart, who's now deceased, was a great example
Brilliant.
Of someone who could just manipulate the media at the snap of his fingers.
Right.
He trained James O'Keefe, who I think is quite good at it. I think the really good people are people we've never heard of, and we don't even know that the news that their fingerprints are all over is totally manufactured. Like the screw guys you mentioned earlier about Apple, that was like 3 or 4 months ago, and they just came clean now. And they honestly didn't have to. That could go down in history
right.
as being real.
Right. There's, of course, the famous David Mamet movie, Wag the Dog.
Yep.
In which a president who's immersed in a scandal, his people say, oh, we could fix that. They hire a Hollywood producer, and he creates the story. He creates a war. He makes it up out of nowhere.
Yeah, totally. And that's really, really scary. And one of the titles that the publisher threw out for the book, which I thought was funny but not serious enough, was Wag the Blog.
Oh, which I like think it.
Yeah, I think it's a good way of describing how blogs tend to drive the media cycle rather than, you know, support or complement it the way that real journalism, and not to say that blogs can't do real journalism or that journalists always do what they're supposed to, but the idea of deliberately publishing verified, fact-checked, quality journalism should be the driver of the cycle, not random buzz on the internet.
Is Nick Denton the worst practitioner of this in Gawker?
I think Gawker is very bad. But what I try to say in the book is that, well, I don't know if I say this in the book, but I've met Nick Denton several times. He's invited me to parties. I know him. We email from time to time.
He probably likes you.
He's an incredibly smart businessman.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't invent this stuff. He's responding sort of to the business environment as it currently exists. And I think Arrington is the same way. It's ultimately going to be up to the public to say, hey, you know, the media is in a way a public trust. and we have to protect it from any one man or woman bending it to their personal profitable enterprise.
I think Mike is so smart that he figured it out and participated in it. He is a master manipulator of the media.
I mean, absolutely. And I think, honestly, the only reason he's not running TechCrunch today is he might have gotten a little too greedy for his own good and tried to run Crunch Fund, an investment fund in startups, simultaneously with writing the biggest blog about startups. And people were finally like, you know, enough is enough.
Yeah, except that it's still going on, and there are other ex-TechCrunch people doing exactly the same thing.
It's kind of obscene.
And everybody knows it, and nobody says a thing.
No, I think I think Pando Daily has some good posts.
That's the example, Sarah Lacey and Pando Daily, who took investors from the very people she's covering.
Right, and the idea that simply disclosing that conflict of interest eliminates it, to me, is just preposterous.
Yeah. Now, I have to tell you, my good friend, Jeff Jarvis, he hosts a show which was on this show. You call him an idiot in this book. He was just on, and he says he's not fond of you either. But I have to say, after reading the four mentions of Jeff Jarvis in this book, it feels like you were hoping Jeff would write about you. It was more...
Yeah,
it was
you know,
more
you know
like
what?
Provoking him to write about you. You're still doing it, Ryan.
Look. I think there are some major flaws in the theories that Jeff Jarvis very handsomely advances in his classes and his high speed speaking gigs that he really needs to answer to.
Okay, let's address him. Let's hear.
Well, there's a great example. I mean, he advises I live in New Orleans, and based on the sort of the online first media model, they've just discontinued printing their print daily.
The Times-Picayune, yeah.
Yeah, the Times-Picayune. Well, New Orleans is one of the most corrupt cities in the United States, and having seen online journalism not just not fight against corruption, but really embrace it, like the TechCrunch thing we were just talking about, I think the idea of getting rid of that daily newspaper and replacing it with online page view centric journalism is going to cause a whole lot of problems for the city of New Orleans. And I know Jeff Jarvis was a big advocate of that model. I know he advised
Here's where I would correct that. And I know Jeff would say this. It's not that he was advocating it. He was observing that this is what's happening.
Yeah, but we can observe what's happening and not just sort of accept it as an inevitable fate. I think we need to pioneer a new model here where the online medium supports real journalism that is loyal to its readers and not loyal to its advertisers.
And that I would agree with you. And I don't think Jeff is looking for journalists that are loyal to their advertisers. I think he is not saying that, but you're right. But what he's really saying is that the old media is dead and they weren't any better, and you certainly don't deny that. But I think you and he and I would all agree that we do have a problem with blogs that clearly don't care about their readers one whit.
I'll put it this way. Jeff spends a lot of time criticizing the things that journalists do wrong.
Right.
And I don't remember the last time I saw a post on his site criticizing what blogs do poorly or criticizing much online journalism, period. And I feel like the web is now the sort of the dominant cultural medium. Right. And we don't need to keep beating this dead horse. We need to say, look, here are the new standards for how journalism should be done. Here's what we're going to accept. Here's what we're not going to accept. And we need real critics and ombudsmen to regulate what is right now a sort of a wild, unaccountable west of journalism online. So I guess my problem with Jeff is not that he's responsible for any of this stuff, but he is paid to cheerlead it and not to question it. And we really need people to question it more than we need them to cheerlead it.
Well, I don't know if he's paid to cheerlead it, but I do agree that we need to question it, that there are some serious issues. And I would guess that Jeff feels like that's so obvious that he doesn't need to write about it. But maybe not.
Look,
I don't know. I think he also probably feels that that will be handled in time, that this is it is the Wild West. It's a nascent medium, and so a certain amount of craziness happens.
I mean, I think we all know the sort of tech speaking writing book racket where it's a lot easier to get attention and get money from people to say how awesome the internet is than to say, hey, there's good and there's bad. Here's what we need to improve. Here's what we don't know yet. It's the same with iterative journalism, right? Which I think is Jeff's biggest example of advocating a concept whose consequences he doesn't fully acknowledge, right? Yeah, it's awesome for people to report things as they know it, but what are the consequences and what are the downsides? And to me, I think those downsides very much outweigh the benefits of getting news about the iPhone 25 minutes earlier.
Iterative journalism is that we'll fix it in post. We'll fix it later. If we make a mistake now, it's not so important.
Yeah, and there's sort of this mindset of, hey, I'm just getting mine, I'm doing my part, and I'm outsourcing the rest of the responsibility to the crowd or to the cloud. Right. You know, it's like, I said my piece, now it's up to everyone else to correct what they think is wrong, rather than a model of accountability and personal responsibility.
Well, we should get Jeff on the show at some point with you.
We should. I'd love to talk to Jeff. I read his stuff. I've read his books. I don't feel like I'm saying this as someone who isn't familiar with his work.
No, I understand. Yeah. And he would probably say, well, you already said you're lying right in the front of the book. Why should we trust you, Ryan Holiday?
Well, look, if I wanted to deceive people, I would have just kept doing what I was doing quietly in the shadows. The last thing I would do is write a book where I give away all my secrets.
Well, why did you? What was it? Did you have a crisis of conscience?
Yeah, it wasn't one thing. It wasn't like I woke up and someone was like, here, do this awful, evil thing. And I said, no, it was more like I slowly realized that my perception and my understanding of how the media works was fundamentally different than how the public's was. And that the rest of the media was kind of operating the same way. Behind closed doors, everyone talks about this stuff. And I don't think there's anything in the book that I disclose that most people don't know or have seen before. But I think open secrets are just BS, and I wanted to sort of get this off my chest and go public with stuff that you know, I use it to sell T-shirts and books, but you can use them for a lot less innocuous means.
We're talking to Ryan Holiday, his book, and I think is a must read. Trust me, I'm lying. You say people know this; it's an open secret. But when you actually read some of these stories, it is worse perhaps than people realize. We're going
to
talk.
Yeah, look, no reporters came to me and said, hey, it's not like that at all.
No.
They all said,
it's obvious.
Worse.
It's worse.
Yeah.
We'll have some more in just a bit with Ryan. But first, a word from our friends at stamps.com. It's time to stop going to the post office and start printing your own postage from your own computer and your own printer right at your desk. In fact, you never need to leave your desk. The mail carrier will come and pick it up. You can even schedule free pickups. They've got the USB scale, so you always know exactly what postage. And it looks very professional. We use it. We print right on the envelopes. In fact, it works with QuickBooks. So your invoices, your billing, all of that, you just press a button. It takes the invoices, prints them out, bills it, puts it on the stamps on the envelope. It really saves you time. It really saves you money. In fact, there are actually discounts. The post office loves stamps.com. They would love it if you would stay home. It has discounts of 21%, up to 21% on express mail, up to 15% on priority mail. Now, if you go to stamps.com, you say, I'd like to try this out. We can get you a 30-day trial, but don't do the one on the front. Click that microphone on the upper right-hand corner and enter Triangulation, the name of this show, in the promo code spot, and ooh, $80 turns into a $110 bonus offer, including $55 in free postage. You'll use that over a period of a few months. You can't use that all in the trial month. But it's, hey, $55 free postage. You get a free digital scale. You pay the $5 shipping and handling to make up for that. They give you a $5 supply kit and a four-week trial. Stamps.com. It's legal. You don't need any special ink. You don't need a postage meter. You just need stamps.com, a computer, Mac or PC, and a printer. Stamps.com. Do try, but make sure you use the triangulation offer code so you get that $110 bonus offer. We thank stamps.com for supporting our shows. And we thank Ryan Holiday for confessing his media manipulations. What do we do about this? I mean, it kind of makes sense that it was just going to happen because of the nature of blogging. They've got the way they make money is by driving page views.
the way, and you see it, you even talk about this, is, for instance, it's much better to do a headline in a blog, Nick Denton knows this very well, with a question mark than an exclamation mark. Would you explain why that is?
Well, yeah, so an exclamation point means that the headline says everything that you're trying to say, whereas a question means you've got to click it to figure out if the answer is yes or no.
It also means you could say the most outrageous things in the headline and put a question mark in it. Is Ryan Holiday a murderer? Question mark.
Right, or,
and then they say no, but...
Right, did Glenn Beck... rape and murder that girl in 1990. It's like you can't defend yourself against that.
Right.
It's the perfect sort of rhetorical trick.
And in fact, Nick Denton tells his writers to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the other Gawker writers I quote in the book, he says, you know, put everything you can in the headline and then leave just enough out so you can click.
And it's all about grabbing people. This was dig.com was you know, you could, it was almost a formula by the time Dig was over. Where you
right.
you knew exactly what to write on a Dig headline so you would get the links. You would get the clicks.
And when there's so much traffic at stake, it's no one can afford not to engage in these tactics. So, I mean, I think the model is fundamentally at fault. And we've got to examine that model if we don't want people to do these things.
Like, so in other words, it's not going to get better.
Right. I mean, look, I think Seth Godin says this. He says, when you give a human being a number, we try to make that number higher.
Right.
And the things that blogs do to make that number higher, and I analogize this to the body count in Vietnam, when you just tell people make a number as high as possible, they end up doing some evil, messed up things. And right now, the numbers that bloggers focus on are so short term that the quality journalism is not a byproduct of what they do. And accurate information isn't a byproduct either.
You talk about Business Insider and Henry Blodgett. It always puzzled me that Henry Blodgett was banned from trading by the SEC and then immediately found a platform in which he could write anything he wanted.
Right. He probably has more influence over the markets today
than he did as an analyst.
Yeah. And it's really, I mean, when you take $7 or $10 million in venture capital funding, you have to show a return very quickly because, you know, you're going head to head on their spreadsheets against Foursquare and all these real startups that are multi-million dollar plays. And so, I mean, Bleacher Report just sold for almost $200 million. That's the ticket that all these guys are after. And you know, building a media brand that's going to be here in 100 years is kind of at odds with making a return on a $7 or $10 million investment within 2 years.
So, but I don't understand how we could fix this. I mean, I understand why it's a big problem, and it's kind of it's a systematic problem.
Systemic is a great word for it. Yeah, absolutely. And first off, I tried to end the book without some nice, fancy, you know, three-page solution at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, because those books, if you read books about media criticism from 10 years ago, the solutions that they have, they never worked out because new things happen all the time. So I kind of felt like my role was to, although you and I know that this is a problem and we've known it's a problem for a long time, most people don't, I would say. And so I wanted to change that first. And secondly, in terms of solutions, I think underpinning all this is a lot of bad assumptions. For readers, it's that, you know, you can get great news and never pay a penny for it. Like, that's what we do. We say, hey, the news is very important to me. I will pay $0 for it. And then we wonder why we get crap.
Here's a great example, by the way. Front page, Gawker.com. Obama grants interview to racist teen nude picture website.
That's brilliant.
He just did a Reddit AMA.
Right.
And Gawker writes, Obama grants interview to racist teen nude picture website. That's going to drive links.
A lot more than Obama does public Q&A session on website.
Holy cow.
Right. I mean, and so for me, I go back and forth from respecting the sort of ingenuity and then being appalled at it at the same time.
It's true. I mean, Now, Nick, you got to remember Nick Denton's British, and he comes from a great tradition of British journalism that is this way.
Right.
Right? I mean, more so than even the U.S. newspapers.
What's interesting about Nick to me is he's already independently wealthy.
I know. He doesn't need the money.
Right. So why, like, it's interesting that he would do all this essentially not for monetary gain, but because he likes it. And so I don't think evil overlord is a bad description of a guy like that.
I think he's laughing all the way, and it's not to the bank. He's just laughing all the way. So here's a quote from the coda of the book. Fake news. I don't mean fake news in the Fox News sense. I mean the fake news that clogs up most newspapers and most news websites for that matter. The new initiative will go nowhere. The new policy isn't new at all. The product isn't revolutionary. And journalists pretend that these official statements and company press releases actually constitute news. It's fake news, manufactured, hyped, rehashed, retracted, until at the end of the week, you know no more than the beginning. You might as well wait for a weekly like The Economist to tell you what the net position is at the end of the week. Who said this? Nick Denton.
And that's what I say in the book is, like, that's like Kim Kardashian complaining that reality shows are too fake.
He says he's on a jihad against fake news, but what that's all. Obama grants interview to racist teen nude picture website.
Or, I mean, my favorite one was last week. Gawker broke a hard-hitting exclusive that Mitt Romney had assets in the Cayman Islands. Well, Gawker's based in the Cayman Islands.
Oh, really?
That's where they're incorporated. Yeah. And that's public knowledge. And it's like the hypocrisy knows no bounds, but that doesn't prevent them from holding the moral high ground. Because now, on the internet, it's madness.
Doesn't matter. You disclosed it, so it's okay.
Right, exactly. And I'm not sure they did disclose it. It's that, you know, this feeds right into, like, Daily Kos is going to write a story about that because it confirms what he believes. He's not going to say, hey, it's a little hypocritical that Gawker is saying this. I'm going to give Romney a pass this time.
Right. Now, that raises a question. I mean, one would look at this Gawker headline and say, well, obviously it's politically motivated, but I don't think it is. Is it?
No, I think they're financial. Like,
they're cynical. You know,
right. And I think Chomsky says this in Manufacturing Consent. He says people don't have to deliberately conspire to distort the news. They can do it because of mutually beneficial incentives. So I think a great example of this was Andrew Breitbart. Look, he founded both. He was a founding employee of the Drudge Report and of the Huffington Post. And those are two opposite sites, but it's at the end of the day the same business model that he's able to understand. And I think these sites, although they may be politically different, they may have one may be a hipster site, one may be a conservative Christian site, but at the end of the day they're all playing the same game, and that's get lots of traffic. And they do the same things with different words and with different political viewpoints.
I think that's what really bugs me is how deeply cynical it is. If you have a strong political, you know, you have a strong belief, you're deeply conservative or deeply liberal or whatever, that's one thing. But this is so cynical and manipulative. That bothers me more.
No, I agree. I mean, my ultimate, so the book is two halves. The first half is, you know, sort of how to manipulate the media. I wanted to show people how it works. And the second half is sort of what it means. But I end the first chapter in the second book by realizing that there was me manipulating the media and a Gawker reporter that I was working with. I kind of realized we're in the same racket. We're both manipulating the media. And it's interesting to see someone like Nick Denton, who ostensibly is a publisher, a newsman, not just allowing manipulation to happen, but sort of encouraging it and engaging it in himself.
So I would like to go back to the first part. I'm jumping all over, but okay. I would like to talk to us about some of the tactics people use to manipulate, and so that you at home can use some of these yourself.
You don't have to like the game, but it is being played. And if you want to get, you know, attention for your startup or your book or whatever, this is up against.
Yeah. So give me some examples. I will not use any of these. I'm just going to tell you, I'm not going to use any of them, but go ahead and give me some examples.
Well, I my favorite one is the one about Help a Reporter Out, which is a service that not a lot of people know.
Unbelievable. Yes.
Right. It's basically a service where lazy reporters go on and they say, hey, I need a source for this story I'm doing about boats. and someone says, I'll be your story as long as you you mention my boating company or you mention my boat sales website. And the source and the reporter sort of conspire. The reporter says, I don't want to do any work. And the source says, I want to get some free promotion. And they work together. So one of the things I did in the book was I pretended to be an expert source for nearly 6 months on Help a Reporter Out. And I set out to prove that, you know, blogs will print anything. And as it turns out, through this, I got on the website of MSNBC, the Today Show, ABC News, the New York Times, and pretty much every other major media outlet that you can think of fell for this because they all have to print so many stories so quickly that really vetting their sources and actually finding a man on the street to interview for the story is just not part of the process.
Too much work.
Absolutely.
What were you an expert in?
Turntables. I don't own a turntable. I've never listened to an LP. Boat winterization. I claimed I had insomnia. I claimed I was a germaphobe. Just some of the most ridiculous things you can imagine. And at one point, it got so easy that I stopped doing it, and I just had my assistant pretend to me, and he did it for me.
It's still online, helpareporter.com, if you want to participate.
Yeah, and look, I did this as my real name. Nobody Googled me and found out that I was writing a book about media manipulation, which is like the second Google result for my name.
That's really the biggest indictment, is that because they didn't want – they wanted you to be an expert.
Right. Why risk it?
It's not that it was too hard to Google you. It's they didn't want to find out.
They suspend disbelief. I mean The other big thing that people don't know drives a huge amount of the information you see in the media is Wikipedia. I mean, reporters when they are describing someone where they went to school, what they majored in, where their first job was, all that kind of stuff, they're not calling up the person's mother and getting that information. They just pull it up from Wikipedia and they hope that the citations are true. And so people control and influence their Wikipedia pages. Because they know it's going to show up in the media. The only problem is studies have shown that I think 60% of all Wikipedia pages about companies contain major factual errors. You know, Wikipedia is reliable, but it's also very unreliable and it's in a state of flux.
Right.
And so Wikipedia influences the reporting in the New York Times, and then people cite the New York Times on Wikipedia, and it's this weird feedback loop of reality.
Yeah. Tim Ferriss is obviously a fan. He says, Ryan Holiday is part Machiavelli, part Ogilvy, and all results. This whiz kid is a secret weapon you never heard of. You actually quote Tim in Tactic Number 3, give them what spreads, not what's good. Tim says, study the top stories at Dig, and you'll notice a pattern. They all polarize people. If you make it threaten people's behavior, beliefs, or belongings, it'll go viral.
Yeah, and Tim's a great – like, look, Tim doesn't engage in the kind of tactics that I talk about.
No, but he's a pretty good promoter.
Right. No, that's what I was going to say. He's an amazing promoter, and you see this in the title of his books, right?
Right.
He could have called this, like, how to work a little bit less.
No.
But no, he called it the 4-hour work week because he knew some people would love it and other people would hate it.
Polarized.
And in a way, the people who hate it promote the message more than the people who love it. And when I hear someone – saying, hey, you can't really work a 4-hour work week. I think, 4-hour work week? That sounds great. And then I pick up the book.
Philip Kaplan, Pud, was the first person to explain this to me. He had a website. Pud's brilliant. He says, I just create websites that run themselves, and then I collect the money at the end of the day. He had a very famous website called Eft Company. Eft stands for. That would publish in internal memos that people would give him of how bad their company was.
Right.
And the way he got Eft Company started, he told me this once, is he would go to forums and blogs and say, can you believe the stuff this guy is printing on this blog? This guy should be shut down. He was doing exactly what you did with Tucker Max. It's much better to get people angry about something than to get people like something.
Right. And like for young men, when feminists say this is offensive, you should never read this.
Oh.
They go, that sounds awesome. That sounds like exactly the kind of
catnip.
Thing I would like. Right.
You say giving the bastards what they want.
Yep.
When I design online ads for American Apparel, I almost always look for an angle that will provoke outrage, self-righteousness, and titillation. All work, and this is interesting, equally well. You'd think it'd be sexy would work best, but no
outrage. It does work, but they all work. And sometimes, you know, you do too many, you know, scantily clothed ads and people start to get tired. So
you've seen two, you've seen them all. Exactly.
Yep.
Dogs wearing clothes. Ad copy that doesn't make any sense. kids dressed up like adults. I once ran a series of completely nude advertisements featuring porn star Sasha Gray on two blogs. They were very small websites. The total cost of the ads, $1,200. Massive online story picked up by Nerve, BuzzFeed, Fast Company, Jezebel, Refinery 29, NBC New York, Fleshbot, the Portland Mercury. It finally made it to Rolling Stone, Brazil, and it's still being passed around. $1,200, two ads, boom.
Yeah, and the best part is there's no clothes in the ads.
Like, it's an American Apparel ad.
Right. And nobody stops and goes, hey, why are we writing a story about an advertisement? Isn't that not news? But in today's world, it's where news. Blogs need so much material, right. Advertisements are as good a kind of content as any.
Anything that gets people to click, right?
It's absolutely.
All, you just need people to click the link.
Yep.
It's called SEO, and it's all that matters. You talk a lot about press release journalism as well.
Yeah, I think there's way too much reliance on press releases because bloggers don't have the time or the interest to cultivate their own kind of sources.
Right.
And, you know, a press release is basically a pre-written story. So it's funny, you know, if you Google key phrases from a press release, you'll see and I only noticed this myself having written a press release and then noticing my own writing appearing essentially word for word on the sites that I read. But if you really track press releases, you see how shamelessly blogs and mainstream media reporters, you know, repeat it word for word. That every episode of The Daily Show is basically Republican journalists repeating, you know, Republican talking points word for word after one right after another.
You talk about The Daily Show and a campaign against The Daily Show that got a lot of publicity.
Yeah, I mean, they were sort of, I think, wrongfully accused of discriminating against women by a blogger who has a history of breaking flimsy, controversial stories that get a lot of traffic. And when you're accused of something heinous like that, of rape, of sexual harassment, of racism, or it's so hard to defend yourself because, well, first off, everyone expects you'll deny it, so they don't
right.
they don't listen, and the accusation is so much more interesting and provocative and spreads faster than your defense ever will be. And so we saw that with that. It's, you know, she writes this inflammatory story, and then The Daily Show posts a signed letter from every woman on the staff of the show denying the accusations, and the New York Times headline about it is, you know, The Daily Show denies that it discriminates against women. And it's like, you already lost at that point.
Yeah, what do you remember? How do companies defend against this?
That's what I wanted to show in the book, because I've experienced that so many times myself. You really can't do anything but just take it.
Well, you talk about reputation management.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately what happens is it creates a feedback loop where when you're accused of untrue things,
you've got to drown it out
with either fake-ish things or manufactured news, or you've got to run that many more advertisements to out-chatter the bad chatter.
Snark.
Yeah, we all know snark.
David Denby wrote a book called Snark. It's mean, it's personal, and it's ruining our conversation. It's absolutely ruining the conversation and online. There's no question about it.
That book was a great example. This guy writes a thoughtful critique of snark, and what happens? He just gets snarked endlessly for daring to write about this thing. And it's sad because I think I talk about this a little bit, like, people online love to call other people douchebags.
Right.
And it's a great word. I mean, I use it myself, but it's so unfair because how can you defend yourself against being called a douchebag? If I say, Leo, you're a douchebag,
I'm not
a douche. That's the douchiest thing you could say.
I am not a douche. Bloggers, you say, bloggers love to hide snark in adjectives to cut an entire person down with just a few words. You find it in nonsensical mock superlatives. Obama is the compromiser in chief. Jennifer Lopez is Jennifer Lopez. Dove Charney is pervy. Jennifer Love Hewitt gains a few pounds and becomes Jennifer Love Chewitt. It's very hard to get that out of your head once you hear that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, like, if a stand-up comedian is doing it, it's one thing. But if a journalist is doing it, right, and they're saying it in front of thousands of people, and it sort of takes on a life of its own, it's that humor spreads so much better online than the fairer, more nuanced version of that person. Yeah, Obama makes a lot of compromises, but maybe there was a reason for that.
It's called politics.
I don't know, but,
yeah.
Right. I feel like if you're going to criticize someone, you've got to do more than come up with a funny nickname.
Or, and as you say, Adam Sternberg in New York Magazine defends it. He says, irony is a logical self-inoculation. Snark, irony's brat, good writer, by the way, flourishes in an age of doublespeak and idiocy that's too rarely called out elsewhere. Snark is not a honk of blasé detachment. It's a clarion call of frustrated outrage.
I would say that's generous, to put it lightly.
All right. We call the show Triangulation. You notice there's only two of us. We have the third part of Triangulation is our chat room, and they have lots of questions for our guests. We're going to get to them in a second. Ryan Holiday is the author of, I think it's a great book. I really do, despite how you dis my good friend Jeff Jarvis. Trust me, I'm lying. We'll get the two of you on. You can battle it out another time.
I would love that.
Yeah, Jeff is we'll see if Jeff will go along with it. He's probably scared of you, as I should be. But
well, no, I honestly really appreciate it, because a lot of journalists or people in the media, I think they sort of buried their heads in the sand a little bit about this book, and I, you know,
no,
I appreciate you giving me a chance to come on and talk about
it.
Oh, no. As controversial as it is.
It's not controversial. It's obvious. I've been saying this for years, that there's no controversy in here. This is, and everybody watching knows that blogs do all of these stupid things. It's patent. Anyway, we'll get there. People want to know about Dove Charney, so we'll get to that too. Is it Dove or Dove?
Dove.
Dove.
Yeah.
He's the CEO and founder of American Apparel.
Yep.
And a close personal friend. Of not of me. He lives in a masturbatorium, you know.
Of course. What does that even mean?
That's what I end up. It's in the book.
I know. And it's like, what response do you have other than
you
the,
can't what say. What does it even mean? You know, he's not the master of his own domain. Oh my. And you know, you talk about Mac Rumors. It's a blog devoted to rumors.
Right. And you know, Apple's a publicly traded company, and these rumors affect the stock price, and it has a real impact. I mean, I've seen, you know, I was at American Apparel and we got sued once. It was a totally bogus lawsuit that was eventually thrown out, and our stock price, the market cap dropped something like $20 million in a single day.
Right.
And that's a lot of money.
Right.
And
right.
And when it happens to Apple, it's not in the millions of dollars.
Billions.
It's in the billions of
right.
dollars.
Right. Well, and I think Apple's learned. I think they've now actually they hired somebody like you, it's obvious that they've totally got the Wall Street Journal and a few other people, and they're planning their own rumors because they know this is the only way to combat it. You cannot do it otherwise. You cannot release.
And then blogs criticize Apple for being secretive, as though like they have any other choice.
How dare they not tell us exactly what they're up to?
Right.
Our show today brought to you by our friends at Ford Motor Company, the Blue Oval. They've got a new site. Actually, I like this site a lot. It's social.ford.com. You can visit it. It's kind of there's articles there. In fact, I have an article there on an interview I did with Jim Buczkowski, who's a Ford technologist, about the future of Ford Sync, their API, and self-driving cars, which every time I talk to Ford, I ask him about this. And it's interesting how their attitude has changed over the years. They're getting closer and closer. While you're there, you can look at the ideas section where people submit ideas to Ford. It's a suggestion box, but it's kind of 21st century suggestion box. And you can vote on the user-posted ideas, vote them up or vote them down. You can also grab a badge. I don't understand this. This is something the kids like to do, I guess.
I would get the Mustang badge. I'd drive a Mustang, but there's also the Tech Geek badge. And then I don't know what do you put it on Facebook or something? You do something with it. It looks like a NFC chip or something. Anyway, it's fun. It's a great site, and I think it's a really interesting. Ford is such an interesting company. They really are trying to take what a more than 100-year-old classic American industrial company and make it a 21st century company. And I think they're doing it better than anybody else. They're knocking it out of the park. Visit social.ford.com. And don't forget, of course, to test drive a Ford at a Ford dealer near you. You might want to take a look at that 2012 Ford Focus Electric. Next year, it's going to be that energy, the Fusion. I cannot wait. The plug-in hybrid. Social.ford.com. We thank Ford, another great company that's been very supportive of our efforts here at Twit. All right, so the chat room wants to know. I should give him a plug. We're talking to Ryan Holiday about this extraordinarily controversial book that so many press people will not talk about. Trust me. How's that? Did I do good? Trust me. I'm Lying, which is the best name for a book ever. And he's got a... Do you even smoke? Because it's got, like, you're smoking a cigarette, which means you're completely untrustworthy immediately.
No, it's funny. That's based on a real picture, but I had a pen in my mouth, and a pen is not as cool looking as a cigarette.
You look like an operative. He's an operative, folks. And director of marketing at American Apparel. How long have you been doing that? You're a young guy.
Yeah, since I was 20, and I'm 25 now. So
that is so cool.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Are you Dove Charney's love slave?
No, Robert Greene, who blurred the cover of the book, he's on the board of directors, and I've been an advisor. I apprenticed under him, and I came in through Robert when American Apparel had some problems like the ones we're talking about.
You were the guy who was the fixer.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us about, you got some good Dove Charney stories? He has a reputation, doesn't he? Is it undeserved?
It, completely. And look, no one's going to believe me saying this, but
he's douchebag.
He's 40 years old. He started a company when he was 19 that now employs 12,000 people in 22 countries. That's the largest garment manufacturer in the United States that completely upended how manufacturing is done. It's vertically integrated. It doesn't use sweatshops. It pays its workers the highest wages in the world. And all anyone wants to talk about is the advertisements and his sex life. And I think that's a good that's very emblematic of our priorities as a media system and as a culture.
Yep.
And I can work for whoever I want. I choose to work for him because I think he's a great boss and a good person. But again, very biased.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. Other questions from the chat room, folks, if you have any, I would be glad to. Can you believe he's 25 years old? Look what he's doing. Oh, see, and they're repeating all those rumors. How do you fight that? What can you do? You know, every company in the world now follows Twitter and follows the blogs. Are they giving blogs and Twitter too much power or not enough?
I mean, absolutely. I quote a study in the book where I think it's something like 89% of journalists admit to using social media as a source for their stories. And I mean, how can they not? If something is so popular as to trend on Twitter, then it's inherently newsworthy. The problem is it might not be true. And real journalism takes more time than the immediacy of the real-time media cycle can allow. So I think that's the problem is people right now are not – their bosses don't demand that they stop and think. In fact, they kind of ask that they don't do that.
Right. Is there a way, one of the chat room asked, Web6050, to some non-corrupt way to generate the same kind of traffic online buzz for a product? Do you have to be – corrupt like this to get that buzz going?
No, I mean, so I tried to write a post about this for Tim Ferriss's website where I talk about how to get attention in an attention economy. I say, look, these are the extremes that I went to. You don't have to go there, but this is the game, and you've got to know how it works. Here's how you sort of do it in a more ethical way. And I think the big way to do it is to realize what the interests of the reporters are, and their interests are not necessarily to write. They're not trying to break politically significant stories because they care about democracy. They they're doing it because there's page views in it. So if you're trying to promote your charity, the fact that you're doing good things is not enough. You've got to present a compelling angle, and you've got to show why this story is going to get Facebook likes. And if you can do that, I wouldn't say that that's necessarily media manipulation, but it certainly is more aggressive and an untraditional way of approaching getting publicity.
You said you studied with Robert Greene. Have you studied people like Edward Bernays, the father of public relations, people like that? He was the first guy to do that, wasn't he?
Look, he was.
He invented
Right, and it's not a coincidence he was related to Freud, which right. I think is really interesting. And in fact, I based so much of what I talk about in the book based on media criticism that I read from 150 years ago, people talking about this sort of burgeoning public relations industry, how the newspapers are working. And I would read these books that are, you know, 50 years out of print and go, if you just replace the word newspaper with blog or Twitter, this is totally right. works today. So yeah, I did a huge deep dive into all that stuff because I think it still applies.
Edward Bernays is the guy who got women to smoke. He created during the suffrage movement. So that was what, in the 20s?
Yeah.
He got a bunch of young, attractive women to march down Fifth Avenue in New York smoking cigarettes, got the New York Times to write a piece called Torches of Freedom. Because women weren't supposed to smoke back then. And this was a sign that if you were a liberated woman, you'd smoke cigarettes.
I mean, he also got people to eat bananas because bananas were considered obscene, too, just like cigarettes.
Well, and much less admirably, he worked for the United Fruit Company and managed
yes.
to get the democratically elected president
of Honduras.
Of Honduras.
Yep.
Branded as a communist, and he got the CIA to oust him. This guy
was smart. And that's that's ultimately what drove me to write the book, because media manipulation starts off selling products, and I think it ends in its worst iteration. It ends advocating, you know, bad politics and war. And I quote the thing about Dick Cheney sort of leaking bad information to the New York Times as an anonymous source, then going on TV and talking about that same leak as though he had nothing to do with it and justifying a war that real people fought and died in. So from fake news or fake reports like Bernays is doing comes a real invasion, right. a real overthrow, and it changes reality in what is undeniably a negative way, using the media as a way of tricking people into going along with something.
Well, and as we head into election 2012, it is just going to be and I don't think either side is worse than either. Well, maybe, I don't know. I'm a liberal, so maybe I think the Republicans are worse, but I think they're all wagging the dog.
Oh yeah, I mean, and they can't afford not to because the other person is going to
right.
do it. It's a classic arms race,
right? So they're both gonna pull out every stop to convince you that the other guy. In fact, they're going to, and I already see this, they're convincing the other guy is using these tactics. And you can't trust him.
I mean, I think it was a pretty brilliant move of Obama to do the AMA today.
AMA.
In the middle of the Republican convention.
Right.
Well, what a nice way of dislodging that from the news cycle.
Well, of course, when you grant an interview to a racist teen nude picture website, you're going to get a lot of attention.
Yeah, you are. The internet's going to freak out about it.
Were you in college when you were studying this? How did you get started doing?
Yeah, it's funny how like people are like, oh, you haven't been doing it that long, and it's like, well, this stuff hasn't existed that long.
Right.
Like, I remember when Dig was bigger than Reddit, and that's where I started, and now it's like it doesn't really even exist anymore.
So did you manipulate Dig?
Of course. How could you not? I mean, if anything can send 20,000 to 50,000 visitors to something in an hour or in a day, who's not going to try to manipulate
it's a gold mine. So tell me how you what did you do to flim flam Dig?
Well, I think everyone does the same things, right? It's you come up with the provocative angle that you know is going to get right. some things, and then you send it all out to your friends to vote because you've got the
right.
the sort of I'll scratch your back, you scratch
right.
mine. Then you put the fake votes in there, and then if you get enough juice early on, it takes off on its own, and you sort of figure out exactly how many votes you need in the right subcategory right. or at the right time from the right users, and you know if you light the match, it'll explode. So that was Dig, and it was back when reporters would read Dig and write blog posts about the things that were doing well there.
Right.
Still very much a phenomenon today.
Right.
And so I would help clients get stuff there, knowing that, you know, if we did it right, CNN might call the next morning and say, hey, we want to have you on.
It's just so depressing. It's amazing. Do you know how to make something viral then? I mean, is there a magic formula to making something go viral?
There is. That's not totally what I specialize in, because I'm more specialized in news, and
right.
I think virality is less using the media as a conduit to get to the people, and it sort of more is about person-to-person transmission. But there are firms out there that are amazing at it. I don't know if you know the firm Mechanism, who's in San Francisco, but they basically guarantee that they can make like anything viral. There was this really interesting Fast Company article where the guy was like, make my cat a celebrity, and like, you know, 2 days later everyone's talking about this guy's cat, because Mechanism knows the right people, they know the right circles, and they can retranslate your message and present it in the right way that it's just sort of guaranteed to blow up, and it's, you can charge a lot of money for stuff like that, and so people do it.
John, go to mechanism.com, mekanism.com, and see what they've got on the front page. It's interesting. I always thought that this was a formula you couldn't really crack, that it's just, you don't know what's going to go. It's depressing. I mean, look,
Google put up $100 million to bet on these YouTube providers that have a track record of making viral things, and they're doing it because it's not random luck. Some people are better at it than other people.
Right. That's a different video than I got on. They're doing all sorts. It's an interesting site. It's all in here. This is, I think, a must-read book. I'm sorry. Jeff's not going to like me for saying that. But I do think that this is a real eye-opener. And I think, Ryan, actually, I think you are on the side of the angels on this one, that you are telling people what they need to know. You could find out more at TrustMeImLying.com or RyanHolliday.net. That's his website. The book is available on Amazon. There is a trailer on the website, so you can watch the trailer. Buy the book. Maybe we'll get you back with Jeff, and you two can slug it out. We've got sumo suits left.
That would be very fun.
Yeah, I think it'd
be
great.
I think we need more people. I think I don't want to toot my own horn too much, but I think we need more critics, and it makes the cheerleaders more honest, and it makes the critics more honest.
No, I agree. And the conversation needs to be had. And unfortunately, what makes me sad is I don't know if there's a fix for this. It's kind of, as you say, systemic.
Right. I think awareness is the first step. If there is a solution, it comes after admitting that we have a problem.
Well,
right?
It requires everybody who's watching this, to be aware that our people are trying to manipulate you and not fall for that. And it requires a few journalists to care more about the audience, the reader, than they do about the clicks and the advertiser. And somebody's saying in the chat room, you're lying right now. You're an Amish woman in Ohio pretending to be Ryan Holiday. Thank you, Ryan. Trust me.
Thank you very much for having me. This was very
really
cool.
Interesting. Yeah, fantastic. Wow, what a great subject. I don't know what Jeff just, I think because you called him an idiot. And you know, I just hypothesize he's probably just trying to get Jeff to write about him. I think Jeff's less of a... Look at this. This is the site, Mechanism. Who knows what that is, but it's viral right now. Whatever that is. So they can actually make something viral?
God. What they say.
God, that's depressing. I was going to talk about why RSS died, but we'll save that for another show.
It's sad, but I do love RSS.
I do too. And it dies because you don't generate page views, the links.
Right, the ads aren't as lucrative there.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Ryan, take care. Stay dry.
All right.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.